Hurricane Sandy has wreaked havoc on the eastern seaboard. What can we do to protect ourselves from the extreme weather climate change is bringing?
Adaptation is dealing with the climate change impacts that are now unavoidable over the coming years. And that refers to putting in place protections against stronger storms, deeper droughts, harsher heat waves.
That's Mark Hertzgard. We air a portion of our 2011 interview with him about his book, Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. And were the Dutch really heroic rescuers of Jews during World War II?
I grew up with this myth of Dutch goodness, the idea that everyone had been in the resistance and had, you know, sent Germans the wrong way to the station when they weren't helping their hidden Jews. And as I got older, of course, I grasped it wasn't quite like that. And I wanted to get a sense of what was this country in the war? What was it like for most people? And that does lead you on to issues of resistance, collaboration, good and bad.
We talked to Simon Cooper about his fascinating look at resistance and collaboration through the lens of soccer in the Netherlands. His book is Ajax, the Dutch, the War. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Coastline communities on the eastern seaboard are still cleaning up 1 week after Hurricane Sandy. More than 110 Americans lost their lives. As this show is being produced, another severe storm threatens the region. Not coincidentally, climate change is finally making it into the common discourse. While no one storm can be linked to climate change per se, the effect of global warming on extreme weather events is like the effect of Barry Bonds taking steroids on his record of hitting home runs. More of them are likely to happen more frequently. In 2011, we talked with journalist Mark Hertzgard about his book, Hot. It's about what we can do to adapt to the inevitable consequences of climate change, to buy us some time, hopefully, to solve the climate crisis. Hertzgard says there's much we can do to adapt if the political will is there. In Hot, Hertzgard explores both the challenges and the possibilities. But more than that, it's a kind of cry of the heart for those, like his young daughter, who are part of Generation Hot.
My daughter is part of Generation Hot, and that's my word for the approximately 2 billion young people around the world who've been born since June 23, 1988, which is the day that NASA scientist Jim Hansen testified to the United States Senate that global warming had begun and threatened very, very serious consequences. And unfortunately, since that time, our government and our corporations and the world in general has done very little to heed that warning. And as a result, the problem has continued and accelerated and intensified to where now we're locked in to at least 50 more years of temperature rise. And so in the book Hot, I'm trying to look at how do we cope with that, not just for my daughter, but for all of the children in Generation Hot. And the surprising thing about it is there, as unfortunate as that news is, there is a lot that we can do to deal with it.
The extreme weather we're experiencing now is happening when the Earth's temperature has risen about 1 degree centigrade due to greenhouse gas emissions. Mark Hertzgard says we've already emitted enough greenhouse gases for another 2 to 3 degrees of warming. I asked him what that means for us.
2 degrees, which is going to be very tough to avoid climbing 2 degrees Celsius, that's going to bring impacts that are plenty difficult enough to deal with. Most of what I look at in the book just looks at 2 degrees. And the impacts of 2 degrees include at least 3 feet of sea level rise, include the fact that by the year 2040, 2050, when my daughter's my age, the terrible summer of 2010, which people on the east coast of the United States or in Moscow, Russia, and much of Europe will remember as a particularly hot and humid, brutal, record-breaking summer. By 2040, that's going to be a normal summer. It won't necessarily happen every year, but it's going to happen, it'll be every other year. We're going to lose the polar bears off the planet. We're going to lose the coral reefs off the planet. Here in California, where I live, we are going to lose much of the snowpack up in the Sierra Nevada mountains that provides a large portion of our state's fresh water for both drinking water and for agriculture. And California is one of the main agricultural production areas in the world, especially for fruits and nuts and vegetables. So we are already faced with enormous challenges, even if we do everything right on reducing emissions, which we obviously are falling pretty far short of that at the moment.
And reducing emissions is all about mitigation. Your book, Mark Hertzgard, is mostly about adaptation. Explain both terms. What's the difference, and why have some people, why has there been a controversy between the two?
So mitigation refers to essentially reducing greenhouse gas emissions, and it's what most people think of when they think about fighting global warming. So you burning less coal, switching to solar power, putting up wind turbines, using less oil, and all of that. That's mitigation. You are trying to reduce the amount of emissions that go in the atmosphere that cause global warming and, therefore, climate change. Adaptation is the back end of the problem. Adaptation is dealing with the climate change impacts that are now unavoidable over the coming years. And that refers to putting in place protections against stronger storms, deeper droughts, harsher heat waves. So things like strengthening the levees, which they're doing in the Netherlands and Seattle and King County, Washington, or improving public health systems so that you can deal more appropriately and effectively with heat waves, which they've been doing in Philadelphia and France, and planting trees to help your crops grow better, which they're doing, astonishingly enough, in one of the poorest places in the world, in Western Africa.
I was in France the year of that brutal heat wave in 2003. I've seen record figures that some 73,000 people died as a result of that.
Yes, at the time, this was there was one story in the American press. The New York Times did a story in August of 2003 that talked about how people were dying so rapidly in Paris that the corpses were piling up outside the morgues. And that story was gave a figure of 15,000 people across Europe that died. Later, when I interviewed Sir David King, the British science advisor, he cited government figures across Europe of 31,000. But we now know, on the basis of a 2008 study commissioned by the European Union of the epidemiology of this, that at least 71,449 excess deaths were registered that summer because of the excess heat. 71,000 people in the space of about 6 to 8 weeks. That is more than the United States lost in the Vietnam War in 6 weeks.
That's phenomenal. So let's look at some of the efforts that you take a look at. Let's look at some cities in the U.S. How about where you are first? You live near San Francisco. You don't live in the city, but you live near it.
I do live in the city now. I moved since I finished the book.
Oh, okay. And your wife is actually a commissioner with the San Francisco Public Utilities Commission, so she's got some expertise on these issues as well. How vulnerable is San Francisco?
Well, not just San Francisco, but all of California is going to be quite, we're going to face a challenge. There's no getting around it. The 3 feet of sea level rise is going to create enormous difficulty for us. It's going to put the two main airports in the San Francisco Bay Area underwater, San Francisco Airport and Oakland Airport. Not just the runways, but in the case of San Francisco, also the highways that get you to the airport are going to be underwater at 3 feet. 3 feet of sea level rise would also basically submerge the city's main beach, so Ocean Beach, which is the beach just south of the Golden Gate Bridge. Probably the single greatest threat, though, to California is, again, water. The fact that we're going to lose, the rising temperatures are going to melt the snowpack on top of the Sierra Nevada mountains that separate California from Nevada and provide a lot of our water. And there's just nothing that we can do to prevent that at this point. You know, with the airports, probably what will end up happening eventually is that they'll build seawalls around those airports. With the snowpack, I've yet to find anybody who can think of a way to prevent that snowpack from melting. There are things you can do to deal with the consequences of that, and there'll be two. There'll be stronger floods and, at the same time, greater water shortages. And that sounds paradoxical, but essentially what will happen is that the warming temperatures will mean that the snowpack melts sooner in the year than it should. It will start melting in the late winter and early spring, and the flow of water down into the lowlands will be much stronger, and therefore there will be increased risk of deadly flooding. At the same time, because we're going to be that water will be melting earlier, there will be less of it available in late spring and summer, and especially late summer, when, of course, human beings and animals and plants and everything else that relies on water, that's when we need it, is in the summer, and we're going to have less of it. So that's probably the single greatest challenge that the state faces.
And how do you think that, how can the state adapt to that?
As I say, I think with the sea level rise, there's going to be places that you will put seawalls around, and then other places we're going to have to abandon. And that is a very, very controversial idea, but there's no getting around it. Because we waited too long to get on top of this problem, we're not going to be able to save every place that we'd like, or every one that we'd like.
Talk about that kind of triage. You go pretty deeply into the example of Holland, another a country that I'm very familiar with because my father was Dutch. And, you know, I've just, in fact, I have a friend whose son works on the dikes, and he talks about the fact that, you know, the Dutch are thinking they're just going to have to abandon certain parts of the country. On the other hand, they have a 200-year plan to survive climate change. So tell us a little bit about this example and how do they deal with the issue of this kind of triage, the areas to save, the areas to let go.
Yes, it is remarkable that the Dutch have this 200-year plan to adapt to climate change. And when I first wrote that in an early draft of the book, my editor, when he sent back the manuscript with his comments, he circled it and said, circled the word, the number 200, and said in the margin, typo. And I sent it back and said, not a typo. Because it's just so inconceivable to an American that any country could plan 200 years out. We didn't even plan 20 years out for the most part. So, and one of the things that they say about that is that, look, we are Dutch, and we know that if you looked at our country from the standpoint of Europe, you might say, okay, let's not bother to try to defend the Netherlands. It's too far away. It's going to be too costly to do it. They're too low-lying. But we are Dutch, and we want to keep this land, and we've been here for 800 years, and we are going to work this problem. And they are working that problem. They're spending a lot of money at it, about $1.5 billion a year. And what is perhaps more impressive even than that is that they are making very tough-minded decisions, including, as your question references, moving people out of areas that cannot be defended. And that includes a couple of stories I write about in Hot, are a case where there was a guy who had a plan to develop a resort along the coast. And they had a lot of meetings about it, and essentially the decision was finally made, no, you're not going to be able to do that. It is just too dangerous and too expensive to defend that area, and we will compensate you, but you will not be able to build on that land. And they ended up building instead, the government will be building stronger sea defenses there, and then behind those defenses, they will give the same businessman an area that will be a fishing resort and wetlands area. And he will be invited to do that, which obviously was not his first choice. But the Dutch are fairly tough-minded about all this. And I think it's going to, part of the reason they can do that is that they have 800 years of experience dealing with these issues. And they have a population that essentially trusts in the process, that a population that is willing to pay taxes and believes that the government will spend those taxes wisely to defend them against sea level rise and storms and so forth. That's an enormous advantage.
Yeah, actually, you talk a lot in the book Hot, Mark Hertzgaard, Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth, about what you call the social context. And you point out that, you know, we have here in this country an ideology that government is evil, that taxes are theft, and regulation is unneeded. And you say that this is just a terrible mistake when it comes to adaptation. Talk about New Orleans, and what, you know, what it does the social context do for the survival of New Orleans?
Yes, the social context is so vital. I would just take issue with one small part of what you said. I think there is a loud minority in the United States that thinks that taxes are evil and government is wrong. And they sound like they're bigger than they are because they have a megaphone in the form of a right-wing media machine, Fox TV and so forth. But there's plenty of other Americans who are willing to be grown-ups and to recognize that if you want to live in a civilized society, taxes is part of what you do, part of the price you pay. You pay taxes in order to have police protection. You pay taxes in order to have schools and highways and federal aviation systems that don't let planes crash out of the sky, not to mention military and so forth. So, and in fact, I'll get to New Orleans in a second, but just to set up the contrast, one of the great success stories in this country in terms of coping with climate change is up in Seattle, King County, Washington, where they're strengthening their levees and so forth, and they are taxing themselves to do it. And the county executive who pushed that through got reelected 3 times. How did he do that, despite raising taxes? He did it by going to the people and explaining why the taxes had to be raised, that if they didn't strengthen these levees, and they're against these greater floods of climate change, they could lose $46 million a day out of their economy. And he did that, by the way, before New Orleans gave us such tragic affirmation of that point. New Orleans lost 1,800 people, many, many hundreds of thousands of people whose lives were disrupted, $200 billion in economic losses from Hurricane Katrina. And that was largely because the government there was shoddy, was not on the case. The levees were poorly constructed, terribly maintained, and Louisiana did not have a building code before Hurricane Katrina. Why? Because building codes were disparaged as, oh, that's socialism, that's government planning, that's control, that's not what we want. That ideology, which is quite rampant in many parts of the United States, including the new Republican majority in Congress, that ideology is not going to serve us well in the years to come if you want to survive against climate impacts. You've got to be able to work together, and workable government, effective government, responsible government is an essential part of that.
In fact, you say that, you know, the cost of not adapting to climate change, the cost of not mitigating climate change could reach 25% of GNP. What about the cost of adapting?
Yeah, it's not me who says that. That's a United States government figure of 25%. Yeah, the cost of not adapting is the that's really expensive, you know. And again, New Orleans shows proves the point. They were not ready for even a Category 3 hurricane, and they ended up almost losing New Orleans and terrible human suffering and economic destruction. How are we going to deal with the amount of climate impacts that are now unavoidable? What's already locked in, as we've mentioned, 3 feet of sea level rise, the increase of temperatures, the stronger storms and the droughts, that's going to be very tough, for example, for Phoenix in the southwest of the United States, going to be very, very tough to keep large population centers there, even if we limit the climate change to the current amount. If it gets higher than that, if suddenly we're looking at not just 2 degrees Celsius of temperature rise, but 4 degrees, which we could have easily within 50 years if we don't change our trajectory on emissions, then you reach a point where you probably can't adapt. You know, adaptation is important, but even the strongest advocates for adaptation say, one scientist in the book says, look, if somebody gave me a dollar to spend on either adaptation or mitigation, I'd spend $2.50 on the mitigation, on reducing the emissions to turn down the temperature rise. Because it doesn't take long for you if you think about this, it's pretty apparent pretty quickly that beyond a certain point, we can't adapt. We're not going to be able to adapt to 20 feet of sea level rise. That's going to essentially spell the end of civilization. So we've absolutely got to turn down emissions and switch to a green economy as rapidly as possible.
Some people say we don't really know enough about how climate change will affect us, so we shouldn't worry about it yet. Mark Hertzgard says they've got it all wrong.
That's fairly foolish because, as we've learned on this problem, just because you don't know, it doesn't mean it's going to be better than you think. It can also be worse than you think.
And so far it has. And in fact, you draw the analogy to insurance. I mean, we buy auto insurance not because we've had an accident, but in case we do have an accident. And talking about insurance, tell us about the insurance industry and their response to this, because they seem to be the one industry that does seem to be aware of the need for adaptation.
Yes, parts of the insurance industry are aware, I would say. Not all of the insurance industry. Because if they were all aware, they would be changing how they invest. And you know, the insurance industry is about the biggest investment capital block in the world economy. And most of their investment is still going towards fossil fuels that make the problem worse. But in terms of the adaptation side, the impact side, there are a lot of insurance companies, less so in the United States, certainly overseas. Most of the insurance companies now recognize that climate change is bad news for them. It's going to bring stronger storms and lots of other extreme weather events that will basically cause them to pay out a lot in damages. So I think that's to the good. And if it's to the good that the insurance companies recognize that, and if the insurance companies can use their leverage with other corporations on this, I think to get them not just to put in place protections, but to shift to a green economy as soon as possible, that could be decisive because the insurance industry has such strong leverage within the world economy.
Mm-hmm. In the time we have left, and I know, regrettably, our time is short here, is to talk about the example of New York. You actually say that you might advise your daughter when she grows up to move to New York. Why?
The reason for saying that about New York is that New York is one of the few places in the United States that recognizes this problem and that is working the problem. They haven't done as much yet as they need to, and I'm talking about New York City, not New York State here. But it is certainly all to the good that the local government is so focused and is working together with private industry and local scientists. They've set up their own version of the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change in New York to study what the impacts will be on the New York area, and then to tell, for example, the airports and the subway system and the Port Authority and all of the major infrastructure players there and the private sector people, look, here's what you need to get prepared for. We expect X number of super storms by the year 2025. We expect double the amount of over 90 degree temperature days in the summer by 2020. And they are getting the bureaucracies in both the public and private sectors to begin working this problem. And that is critical. Most of the United States is still in denial about this part of the problem. You know, I've also said in the book that I'd consider advising my daughter to go live in the Netherlands, even though most of the country is 15 feet below sea level. Why? Because they're working the problem, and they're working it very expertly.
And finally, you have a very inspiring story, as you referred to in the beginning of this, at the top of this interview, a story that takes place in one of the poorest countries in Africa of the ways that people are adapting to climate change. Tell us that story about the trees in the cropland.
Yeah, I'm so glad I came across that story because, you know, it's certainly very easy to get downhearted on this topic. And what gives me hope is looking at a story like in West Africa that you mentioned, where some of the poorest people in the world, illiterate farmers in Mali and Burkina Faso and Niger, are adapting to climate change, even though most of them do not know the term. They are experiencing it, but they don't know the term. And the way that they are adapting to the much higher temperatures there and growing drought is by growing trees in the midst of their fields of millet and sorghum. Not planting the trees, growing them. they do not, these farmers do not have enough money to plant trees. They can't buy the seedlings. They can't keep them alive with irrigation systems because they don't can't afford irrigation systems. What they do is they dig little pits. They call them zai, about the size of a, say, a round version of a baseball home plate. And they make a little hollow there, and they put cow and animal manure in there. And thus, when the water, what little rainfall comes, it goes down in there. And that manure has seeds in it from trees, and those that therefore sprouts bushes and trees. And those trees provide shade in the field that help the plants to grow. But more important, their roots go down into the earth, and they aerate the underground soil so that when the rain falls, the rain doesn't just flash off onto the creeks and disappear. The rain soaks down into the ground. And the results have just been unbelievable. I'm not sure I would have believed if I hadn't seen it with my own eyes. The underground water tables are rising. The productivity of the croplands is doubling and tripling. And most gratifyingly, the incidence of child malnutrition in these areas is plummeting. And this is a practice, this so-called regreening of Africa through growing trees. This has been done by the poorest people in the world without a lot of international funding. And they are spreading the idea themselves from farmer to farmer and village to village. It has spread over such a vast area in Western Africa that it is literally, literally, you can see it from outer space in satellite pictures taken by the U.S. government. So I think that's an enormously encouraging story. If people like that, who have so little, can do so much, surely the rest of us can do our part.
Mark Hertzgard, your book, and we just barely touched the surface of it. It's really a wonderful, wonderful book. It's Hot, Living Through the Next 50 Years on Earth. And I think this example that you give is also an example of a principle you talk about in the book, and that is that it's the species that do adapt that will survive.
I couldn't agree more. Thanks so much for having me.
Go to writersvoice.net for a link to a recent article by Mark Hertzgard about Hurricane Sandy. Next up, we talk with sports journalist Simon Cooper about his book, Ajax, the Dutch, the War, the strange tale of soccer during Europe's darkest hour. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Every year this week, Writer's Voice features a segment about the Holocaust in Europe during World War II. That's because on November 9, 1938, the first major anti-Jewish pogrom signaled the beginning of the Nazi assault on Europe's Jews. This year, we talk with British journalist Simon Cooper about his fascinating look at the record of the Dutch in protecting or failing to protect their Jewish population during the war. Cooper writes about soccer. A previous book is Soccernomics, co-written with Stefan Szymanski. In his latest book, Ajax, the Dutch, the War, Cooper uses soccer as a lens to examine the real history of collaboration and resistance during the German occupation of the Netherlands. Ajax is a leading soccer team in the Netherlands based in Amsterdam. Simon Cooper, welcome to Writer's Voice. This book, Ajax, the Dutch, the War, uses soccer to shine a light on a far deeper issue, actually, than sports history. It really seems to be a book about the issues of collaboration, resistance, bystander status, and prejudice.
Really, it was a book written because I wanted to get a better sense of what ordinary life for most people was like in the Netherlands in World War II and to some degree across Western Europe in World War II. And because I grew up in Holland. We weren't Dutch, but my dad took a job there. And growing up in a Jewish family, you know, 30 years after the war was when we arrived. The war was still all around us. And I grew up with this myth of Dutch goodness, the idea that everyone had been in the resistance and had, you know, sent Germans the wrong way to the station when they weren't helping their hidden Jews. And as I got older, of course, I grasped it wasn't quite like that. And I wanted to get a sense of what was this country in the war? What was it like for most people? And that does, as you say, lead you onto issues of resistance, collaboration, good and bad, and even whether good and bad is a very useful way of looking at the Dutch and the Western European war.
What do you mean by whether that's a useful way of looking at it?
There is still this story that's often told through movies, through books, by politicians about World War II, which is that there were some very bad people in these countries who wanted to kill Jews and support Nazism, and then they were opposed by the very good people who wanted to hide Jews and be in the resistance. And that story does apply to a very, very small part of the population in countries like the Netherlands or France. But it doesn't apply in Holland, I would say, to about 98 or 99% of the population who were neither pro-Nazi nor did anything much to help the resistance or to help Jews survive. Most people kept their heads down, trying to muddle through the war, were not making moral choices, were... The Dutch words goed en fout, which, you know, when I was growing up, were the routine words used to describe people's behavior in the war. Goed, good, fout, bad. Those words just didn't make sense to the way most people had thought of themselves and had tried to behave in the war. Most people were just trying to get through it.
In fact, there is a book in Dutch called Om Erger te Voorkomen. That means to prevent worse. That was a phrase people often used. Is it true that people didn't get involved because they were trying to prevent worse, because they were at risk of being killed themselves if they did?
There wasn't much risk of being killed themselves because, I mean, that was another surprise to me writing the book. The German occupation of most Western European countries was not very brutal. You didn't get the massacres and the sort of scorched earth that you got in Eastern Europe. The Germans needed to keep Western Europe quite quiet. They couldn't afford to spare many troops or police there. And so in much of France or Holland, you rarely saw a German. As François Hollande, the French president, said the other day, the roundup of Parisian Jews in the Ville d'Yves razzia in 1942, not a single German was involved. It was done by the French police. And in a Dutch town, you could spend the whole war barely seeing a German. So it wasn't that you lived in constant fear of German repression. And also, people in Holland just had no imagination of Nazism and the idea that Hitler would massacre 6 million people in concentration camps. They couldn't imagine that because that had sort of never been part of Dutch history. This had been a very placid country for 300 years before the war. And people just had no idea what had hit them. And the idea, om erger te voorkomen, to prevent worse, there was this idea among the civil service and the police that, you know, if we work together with the Germans, things won't be so bad, then they won't sort of round people up and arrest them and maybe kill them. We need to keep things quiet here, do our jobs, and then everything won't be so bad. And so the collaboration was seen as patriotic. It was, let's work together with these people and maybe we can prevent, you know, very bad things being done and we'll all get through the war okay. There was, I mean, remember in Holland itself, there was very little killing. The Jews were transported to the east where they were killed out of sight. And it wasn't that Germans went around Holland shooting Jews or resistance. This was a pretty placid place and most people didn't really understand World War II until decades later.
And yet there was a resistance, even though everybody after the war pretty much claimed to have been part of it. I think it was something like 1 to 2% of the population that were involved. And I happen to know about it because my father was one of those people, sheltered a Jewish man in his apartment for three years from 42 to 45 and was a courier for the resistance. There were plenty of people who were shot who were part of the resistance. But nonetheless, you contrast this history to that of Denmark. What was the difference between the way that Denmark was able to protect its Jews? What was the critical element there that kind of stiffened their spine, and why was it lacking in Holland?
Well, first let me say, yes, of course, there were people in Holland like your father who did amazing things at risk to their own lives. But these people were a tiny minority. I mean, we're talking tens of thousands in a population of 10 million people. And it's not right that after the war, this group of heroic resistance in France or in Holland, and in France there were proportionally more of them, but it's not right that this small group was made to stand for the nation as a whole. These people were the exceptions. They were totally atypical, and often they were disapproved of by ordinary Dutch people who thought of them as violent adventurers who were getting everyone into trouble. Now, why were Holland and Denmark different? I mean, it's true, Denmark smuggled its Jews across the water to Sweden, almost all its Jews, in a couple of nights. And half of Copenhagen must have known what was going on. I mean, Jews were hidden in Copenhagen hospitals under Gentile names. The Danish police, the Danish Lutheran priests, I mean, everyone was involved. It was a huge Danish conspiracy. So why did it happen? I mean, firstly, you know, this was in 1943, by which time it was clear that Germany was going to lose the war, so people were more emboldened. Partly it was because the Danes had actually collaborated very obediently with the Germans until 43, and the Germans had let them run their own country. So there wasn't much Danish resistance until that point. Partly, perhaps, it was because virtually everyone in Denmark was a Lutheran. I mean, the Jewish population was tiny, but all the Gentiles almost all were Lutherans. And so they were very easily reached by the leaders of the Lutheran Church and influenced by leaders of the Lutheran Church who decided to stand up for the Jews. So it was much easier to get the population to act as one. I mean, I say in the book that it's very remarkable, very striking that Denmark had strong leadership from the Lutheran priests, from the king, from senior government figures who said, look, we're not going to let this happen. We're not going to give our Jews to the Germans. Whereas in Holland, the government had fled to Britain, and the civil servants in charge pursued this policy of, well, we'll give the Germans what they ask for. So once the lead comes from the top, it's much easier for most people to sort of fall into step, to know what's going to happen. You see that in Britain, where I don't want to turn the war into a story of individuals, but I think leadership structures are very important. So in Britain, you see, there's some doubts in the 30s. Should we find appeasement with Germany? Can we work with these people or not? So there's a big debate among the British establishment. And then Churchill says, no, we can't work with the Germans. He becomes prime minister. And then when there's a very clear line, it's quite easy for people to follow. So I think that's part of the Danish story. And, of course, Denmark did have this haven just across the Sound in Sweden, which was willing to take the Danish Jews. Holland didn't have anything like that. Holland didn't have forests. But, I mean, I tell in the book stories of, there's this debate at a football club, which I have the archive for. And in 1941, the Germans say, okay, Jews are no longer allowed to belong to soccer clubs, to sports clubs. So at this soccer club I look at, Sparta Rotterdam, the directors sit down, and their argument is about how big should the board be that says no Jews allowed. I mean, none of them really wants to put up a board that says no Jews allowed. Jews have been members of this club forever. Everyone's very happy about it. The directors are not anti-Semitic. But when the German order comes, the directors of this club don't say, oh, well, we can't do that. That's wrong. They say, well, regrettably, we have to put up a board, but let's not make it a big, tasteless board. Let's just make it a small, discreet board.
A sign.
Yeah, mm-hmm. A little sort of cardboard sign. In fact, I found one of those signs in the club's archive. It still had the pinholes in it, you know, forbidden for Jews. And I guess in 1945, when the war ended, somebody thought, well, be ashamed to throw it away. It's part of the club's history, so they stuck it in the archive, which is where I found it 50-odd years later. So that was very much the trend of discussion in Holland during the war. How big should the sign be forbidden for Jews? And another reason why I think good and bad are not the right terms to explain what happened in the war is that the Dutch Holocaust, in which 80% of Dutch Jews were killed, more than in any other Western European country, it wasn't driven by anti-Semitism or evil. I mean, Holland was a country where Jews and Gentiles had lived in peace for hundreds of years. There were not even populist political parties preaching anti-Semitism. There'd been no pogroms against Jews ever. So if the Germans hadn't arrived, the Dutch would never have killed their Jews. But when the Germans came, the Dutch said, okay, here are the Jews. So, and France was a much more anti-Semitic country. You know, you did have popular anti-Semitic movements. There had been a lot more trouble between Gentiles and Jews. But in France, 75% of Jews survived. So you can't explain these differences just by talking about good people and bad people. And when I was in Denmark researching the Danish part, Danes were very anxious to tell me, look, this is not a fairy tale. We are not a nation of angels. The reason the Danish rescue of the Jew happened was due to very specific factors at the time and a few people making decisions and the circumstances. And I'm very resistant, and the Danes are rightly very resistant, to writing the story of the war as a fairy tale. It's not.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Simon Cooper about his terrific book, Ajax, the Dutch, the War. You know, you just mentioned very particular circumstances. One of the circumstances that many have pointed to in Holland for why so many of Holland's Jews did lose their lives in the war, were murdered in the war, was because Holland was separated into these pillars, these, you know, these Catholics and the Protestants, and they were all very much kind of in and of themselves. And yet it seems that soccer was one of the few places, perhaps, where Jews and Gentiles did get together, and especially in Amsterdam, but also even in Rotterdam, where you explained in Sparta, I mean, that had more Jewish members than any other soccer club in Rotterdam. So talk a little bit about the place of soccer in the Netherlands and how that became a meeting ground between Jews and Gentiles.
I mean, you had different groups of Jews in Holland, and the Jews I saw in this Rotterdam club were quite middle class, and these people were totally integrated into Dutch life, and in fact, they played for a soccer club where most of the members were Gentiles. I mean, these were their friends. Until 1940, they weren't Jews and Gentiles. They were just middle class Rotterdam people who played sport at Sparta. And the Amsterdam Jews were odd because, I mean, you had very upper-middle-class bourgeois families like Anne Frank's family when she came from Germany, you know, educated people who her father ran a company. But there was most Amsterdam Jews, and in fact most Dutch Jews, were proletarian working-class people who lived in the Jewish quarter, which was quite poor in the center of town. And these people, they didn't suffer significant anti-Semitism, I don't believe, but they lived in this Jewish quarter, and that was where most of their social relationships were. So, for example, there were five Amsterdam Jewish soccer clubs where most of the Jews played for. And what you say about pillars, it's true that politically and in society, Dutch life was organized into a pillar. So if you were a Catholic, you were born in a Catholic hospital, you went to a Catholic school, you voted for a Catholic political party, and you were buried in a Catholic cemetery. And you married a Catholic, and that's the way life was structured in Holland in those days. And I think people mix pretty well socially, but when push comes to shove, you vote as a Catholic and you belong to the Catholic pillar. And so the Jews kind of dropped out. When in 1940 the Germans said, okay, you know, we're going to take the Jews, or they already began saying that a year after the invasion from 1941, there wasn't a pillar to stand up for the Jews. And that made a difference. I mean, for example, you saw it in Germany as well. In Germany, people would stand up for their own family. They would risk their lives for their own family. So when Hitler said, well, we're going to sterilize and kill the mentally handicapped, the churches in Germany rose up because Catholic people were not going to stand by and let their own relatives, their own children, be killed. But they weren't willing to make that step for people in other families. They weren't willing to make that step for the Jews, to risk their lives for the Jews. And you saw that in Holland. The pillars had been trained always to think of their own interests first, and so the Jews were sort of orphaned.
So you talked about these five Jewish soccer leagues in Amsterdam. Amsterdam has always been seen as a Jewish city. I mean, this actually surprised me because there are so few Jews in Amsterdam now and have been since the war. And Ajax, which is the Amsterdam team that existed both before the war and now after, is somehow associated with being Jewish. Can you explain this connection?
Amsterdam was never a Jewish city, but until 1940 it was 10% Jewish. And the Jews had been there, or some Jews had been there, for hundreds of years. Rembrandt in the 17th century lived in the Jewish quarter and painted Jews who were his neighbors. And then in the war, 80% of these people are killed, and now Amsterdam is maybe 1 or 2% Jewish. And Ajax has never been a Jewish club. I mean, it's the best club in Holland. It was champion last year. It's won the European Cup, which is the biggest trophy in club soccer in the world. It's a great club, but it always had a very small, marginal Jewish presence among the players. You know, there have been a few over the years, not many. Until the war, the Jews were in the stadium too, watching along with in the sea of Gentiles. And after the war, the few surviving Jews of Amsterdam strangely seemed to cluster at Ajax. So there were a few significant players. I interviewed this guy, Benny Miller, who was captain of Ajax in Holland in the 60s, half-Jewish, products of the Jewish quarter, a few guys like that. And then sponsors. I mean, some of the Jews who survived the war and went into business became sponsors of Ajax. Oddly, in the 60s, the other significant sponsors of Ajax were these brothers von der Meyde, who had been collaborators with the Nazis, who were known as the bunker builders, because they had built bunkers for the Germans along the North Sea and made their money that way. So the Ajax of the 60s, which was just turning into Holland's premier club, was funded by Jewish money and collaborators' money. So Ajax has a sort of Jewish undertone, but it's never significantly been a Jewish club, but it became seen as that. So because of Amsterdam's reputation as more Jewish than other Dutch cities, from the 70s, other fans of other clubs used to taunt Ajax with anti-Semitic taunts. And then the Ajax fans strangely adopted Jewishness as their identity. I mean, most of these guys who stand on the stands now are not Jewish, but they chant, "We are Jews, super Jews," and Ajax are referred to by their own fans often as the Jews. So it's become this sort of myth that Ajax is a Jewish club, which is pushed by the fans themselves in this rhetoric. And in fact, it's not. I mean, the Jews have been a very small part of Ajax.
And I'd like to actually get back to that when we talk a little bit later about what's going on now, which is also a fascinating part of your book and very much linked to the war in a strange way. But tell us a little bit about Eddie Hamel, the story of Eddie Hamel, because it's both emblematic of what happened to the Jews, but he wasn't even Dutch.
He came from a Dutch family. He was born in, I think, 1902, and I think he was born in New York. And he had an American passport, and he lived between the Netherlands and the U.S., and he played for Ajax in the 20s. You know, he was quite a respected player, played for the first team, Jewish guy. And then when the war came, he and his family and his wife and his twin boys were put in a holding camp, the Dutch holding camp at Westerbork, where he met this English Jew called Leon Greenman, who was English-Dutch, and Greenman would end up being the only Englishman in Auschwitz, only English Jew in Auschwitz. And so Greenman and Hamel had been picked up, and they were very anxious to prove that they were British and American respectively, because then the Nazis would let them go, because they would be able to somehow claim status of national status in their own countries. They thought this would protect them, and I think it would have protected them. But Greenman had lost his passport, and Hamel didn't have the documents, because people didn't bother much with passports in those days. So in the end, despite their protests, they were British and American, they were put on the train to Auschwitz with their families. Their families were immediately gassed. And Greenman and Hamel lived in Auschwitz together. They shared a bunk. And in 1943, Hamel had an abscess on his mouth, and he was sent to the gas chambers. And I met Leon Greenman, the British Jew, when he was a man in his 90s in London in about 2000. And he told me the story of Eddie Hamel, how he had known him in Auschwitz, he'd been his buddy in Auschwitz, and Hamel had been gassed. And Greenman had gone around for the rest of his life telling the story of Auschwitz and of his family and of Hamel and the other people he knew. He died a few years ago, aged nearly 100. And so that was Eddie Hamel, who was a nice man, and I tried to reconstruct his story, because one of the sad things about these people who died is that they weren't just killed, but they were forgotten. And I wanted at least to help them be remembered. And that was an important reason for me to write this book. That, for example, in Rotterdam, nobody knows that Rotterdam had a large Jewish population, that these people have been consigned to oblivion. That, I think, is part of the sadness that I was trying to rectify in this book. I wanted to tell the stories of people, and I didn't want them to be remembered just as victims. I didn't want them to be remembered just at the moment that they were gassed in Auschwitz, but I wanted them to be remembered for their lives. So I tried to tell the story of Eddie Hamel, who was a very popular outside right for Ajax in the 1920s.
And we're talking with Simon Cooper. He's the author of, and I'm going to pronounce this in the American way, Ajax, The Dutch, The War, The Strange Tale of Soccer During Europe's Darkest Hour. And there's another story that you tell in the book, Simon Cooper. It's the story of Meyer Stott. It's in the chapter Lost Memories. Why did you call it that?
Well, Meyer Stott was this man who played good soccer and was a prominent athlete before the war. He was half Jewish. And he entered the resistance. He had a very adventurous life in the resistance during the war. And finally, the Germans caught him, and he ended up in Buchenwald, the concentration camp. And as Germany was being invaded by the Allies in 1945, he was executed. He was, he with a bunch of other prisoners was shot in the head. And he survived, and he was found by other prisoners at the bottom of a pile of corpses, and they exchanged his, they smuggled him into the camp and exchanged him for another corpse. And a French professor of medicine, who was a fellow prisoner, extracted 12 bullets from his body. And a year later, Maristot, I think, won a major race in Holland in 1946. And I met him when he was 80, and he told me his story of having been executed and surviving. And so this man with his bizarre life was trying to remember what had happened to him, but if you're shot in the head, you lose some of your memory. So he was always struggling to remember things, and of course there's a mix of fantasy and what you think you remember, what somebody told you. And I was actually very relieved recently to hear the truth about his story about Anne Frank. Because Stott rang me one day, very excited. He'd remembered that he'd met Anne Frank in Bergen-Belsen, and he said she was ethereal. Well, I was a bit saddened by that at the time, because I don't think he could have met her in Bergen-Belsen, because she would have been in the women's camp, and he would have been in the men's camp. But then I spoke to somebody, namely you, Francesca, who told me that you had discovered that Anne Frank and Mayr Stott were in Westerbork, which was the Dutch holding camp for Jews, at the same time. And so he could very well have met Anne Frank in Westerbork, and he misremembered where he'd met her, but it seems that he was correct in remembering that he had met her. And that was the kind of struggle I had with Stott, that he didn't know what he remembered.
Mm. And I'm glad I could help you with that. My father's best friend was in Westerbork at the same time, and what's also sad is that his name was Vincent Vaillant, and Vaillant and Stott, according to your records about Stott and mine about Vincent, were on the last transport out of Westerbork ever to go to the concentration camps. And
My gosh.
Yeah, the very last one.
And you obviously have had access to a list of who was in Westerbork at what time?
Well, I have access to the transport list on which Vincent's name is. I didn't look for Stott's name, but you gave the date of the transport, and I know
that's
that,
right.
And
yeah.
I know that that was the last transport out. And I actually have remarkably letters that were written by Vincent Vaillant out of in Westerbork in the last 3 days before he was transported. And he mentioned being in the punishment camp, and I do know that at the time that's where Anne Frank and her family were in the punishment camp of Westerbork, so I know they must have known each other. They went out a few days earlier to Bergen-Belsen. For many years after the war, the Dutch hewed to the notion of tolerance for ethnic minorities. But that's frayed in recent years with the rise of anti-Muslim sentiment and right-wing racist politicians like Geert Wilders. I asked Simon Cooper, why has this happened?
Partly it has to do with the war, because part of the Dutch post-war ideology was never again Auschwitz. And so the idea was that any racism could lead to Auschwitz, so we mustn't express any racism. And by the early 21st century, it was fairly clear to people, I think rightly, that, you know, Netherlands was not going to get involved in another Auschwitz. So it was possible to be racist without it leading immediately to Auschwitz. And so the taboo on racism began to weaken. And after September 11th, there was a rise of a populist politician called Pim Fortuyn, who was almost the first populist far-right politician in Dutch history. And he did very well bashing Moroccans, saying nasty things about Muslims. And that sort of liberated lots of people to be racist and to say these things about minorities that they had thought before but had never felt free to express. So suddenly there was this blossoming of racist opinion and racist language in the Netherlands, which I describe in the book, and which I was shocked to encounter, that you would go to a dinner party of upper-middle-class educated people, and somebody would talk about how awful Moroccans were. And it's, I think, because the war is now dying in European memory, the Second World War, which was the great sort of anti-racist lesson. that in all sorts of ways, Europe is getting over World War II, and it took 50 or 60 years, but now it's happening. And that, I think, explains why you still, under Geert Wilders, who I know is popular among many with many American neocons, because Wilders now is the guy who bashes the Muslims, that is why somebody like Geert Wilders could become a successful politician in the Netherlands today.
And you see it in soccer. I mean, what shocked me right down to my toes are the soccer songs. You have a whole chapter about this, these songs where, for example, games between Ajax and Feyenoord in Rotterdam, you know, that the people in the stands make the sound of gas escaping to imitate the gas at Auschwitz as a slur against the Ajax team. How does this come about?
Well, the idea that Ajax is a Jewish club and should be teased for being Jewish has really grown over the years. It took off in the late 70s, early 80s, and you did get the point that you have, you know, maybe 10,000 people in the Feyenoord Stadium. Feyenoord are the great Rotterdam rivals of Ajax. Making the hissing sound of escape and gas. And I think it's partly because nobody now believes that kind of thing leads to another Auschwitz. It's seen as just play. And it's raw. It's shocking. These people don't really mean that they wanted gas Jews. But this kind of racist language is now acceptable in the Netherlands in a way that it wasn't 20, 25 years ago.
And do you find it ominous?
I don't find it ominous, no. I find it horrendous and ugly and revolting, and I would take away the season tickets of these people and never let them watch another soccer game. But I don't think it's going to lead to another Auschwitz, no.
Well,
I think it's just really bad taste play, and it allows racist language to spread in public life. But I think Europe is not the 1930s again.
Well, maybe it wouldn't lead to Auschwitz, but it does seem to be of a piece of what you were just talking about, which is a general xenophobic tilt in Dutch politics, not just Dutch, in Germany, even in other places, in Norway, for that matter. I mean, couldn't it link up, do you think, to a political trend?
I think it links to the trend of more freedom to express racist views that you see in the soccer stadium and you see outside. So in 2002, after 9/11, Pim Fortuyn, the far-right leader, said that Islam was a backward religion. And at the time, everyone was shocked. I mean, how could anyone say this? This was just the start of that kind of unleashing of racist language in public discourse. And in the next few years, various leading political figures said variants of Islam is a backward religion. And it became an acceptable commonplace in Dutch politics. And so that sort of parallel trend in the soccer stadiums, where once upon a time people were shocked when fans made the sound of escape and gas to imitate Auschwitz, to taunt Ajax, and now it's become something of a yawn.
Well, the book is, and it's a terrific read, for sports fans, history buffs, for anybody. It's called Ajax, The Dutch, The War, The Strange Tale of Soccer During Europe's Darkest Hour. Thanks so much, Simon Cooper, for writing this book and for talking about it with us here.
Thank you very much.
In addition to Ajax, the Dutch, the War, Simon Cooper is the author of Soccer Against the Enemy and Soccernomics. He's written for The Observer and The Guardian and is currently a sports columnist for the Financial Times. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight into your inbox or subscribe to the free podcast and newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. Drew Adamek is Writer's Voice Associate Producer. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.